Usually when we talk about making a medical diagnosis, there's a built-in expectation of precision, right? It feels almost like engineering.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Like you fall off a bike, you break your arm, the x-ray goes up on the light board, and you know, there's that jagged white line.
Right, it's very binary. The visual evidence just gives you this immediate sense of certainty.
Exactly. The doctor points to it, and you both know exactly what the problem is.
Yeah, the bone is either fractured or it's intact. And we are deeply, deeply conditioned to seek out that level of categorization.
Because it tells us exactly what the intervention is. Put a cast on it, keep it still, let it heal. Boom, done.
Right. It's safe. It's manageable.
But, and this is kind of the jumping off point for us today, the moment you step outside the clinic,
Yeah.
the moment you step into the world of geopolitical conflicts or peace building or just human history in general, that X-ray machine just
It
shatters.
completely falls apart. Yeah.
We're suddenly forced to navigate this diagnostic landscape that is entirely opaque. Because if you look at the most entrenched conflicts of our time, there is no single jagged white line to point to.
No, not at all. And that opacity is, well, it's precisely why so many of our traditional interventions just fail completely.
Right.
I mean, the deepest, most violent crises of the contemporary world, they aren't simply disputes over easily measurable things.
Though we try to treat them that way, don't we?
Oh, constantly. We try to diagnose them as if they're just, arguments over a specific piece of territory or a certain amount of political power or access to natural resources.
Like it's just a math problem we haven't balanced yet.
Exactly. But beneath those tangible elements, there are these vast, unseen psychological and, frankly, spiritual mechanisms at play.
Which brings us to our mission for today. So welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive designed specifically for you if you've ever watched the news and just felt this profound sense of overwhelm at the endless cyclical nature of global conflict.
Which I think is everyone at this point.
Literally everyone. And if you've wondered why rooms full of, brilliant diplomats can't just draft a treaty to fix these problems, well, this deep dive is going to completely upend your perspective.
It really is a paradigm shifter.
Yeah. We're unpacking this incredibly dense 189-page academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saheli. And I mean, the title alone carries immense weight. It's called Life Coherent Discernment and Repair: Regrounding Spirituality, Religion, Peace, and Geopolitical Conflict in the Protection of Life.
It's quite a mouthful, but it's an extraordinary undertaking of synthesis.
It really is.
Dr. Saheli is essentially, going back to your analogy, he's engineering a new kind of X-ray machine for the human condition.
Oh, I like that.
Right. He's attempting to give us a diagnostic tool for the absolute most intractable conflicts on the planet, the ones where standard diplomacy has just entirely exhausted itself.
Yeah, and to really ground us in what we're dealing with, before we get into the heavy theory, I actually want to describe the cover art of this white
But
paper.
please do, it's so striking.
Because it really acts as a visual map for everything we're going to explore. So picture this sweeping, thick brushstroke forming a perfect continuous circle on the page.
Almost like a traditional Japanese enso.
Exactly like an enso,
Right.
symbolizing, emptiness but also completion. And inside the boundary of that circle, anchoring the center of the entire image, is this radiant, ancient tree of life.
But the crucial detail is what it's growing out of.
Right. It's growing directly out of this cracked, arid, just unforgiving earth.
The contrast there is so vital, but the background outside of that circle is what truly sets the stage for the paper's thesis.
Yeah, let's talk about the background. It's split vertically down the middle, showing two vastly different realities.
Right.
So on the left side, you see the absolute devastation of war. We're talking shattered concrete, skeletal remains of buildings, thick gray smoke just choking the sky.
Just total destruction.
And then you look at the right side, and there's a beautifully intact, vibrant cityscape featuring the Dome of the Rock sitting beneath this perfectly clear sky.
And then pulling your eyes back to the foreground.
Yes, right at the base of that ancient tree, emerging from the deepest crack in the dry ground, is a single, incredibly tiny green shoot.
That tiny green shoot, I mean, that is the fragile possibility of repair. It's this life force insisting on continuing despite all the desolation around it.
It's a stunning visual metaphor.
It really is. And beneath that entire visual, the cover lists five foundational pillars that structure the whole philosophy we're about to unpack.
Right, the pillars. They are protect life, repair wounds, restore dignity, reconcile differences, and conserve peace.
Those five. And they pull us directly into the core premise of the paper, We need to start by diagnosing the root of the problem.
Right. Like, why do some conflicts become totally immune to standard political negotiation?
Well, the central thesis argues that today's deepest crises, and we mean whether we're talking about ecological collapse, political polarization, or, you know, brutal geopolitical warfare, they aren't merely failures of institutional design.
They aren't just bad policy.
Exactly. They aren't just security apparatuses breaking down. They are what the paper defines as crises of ultimate concern.
Crises of ultimate concern. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the stakes in these conflicts have fundamentally shifted. Right?
They have. They are no longer about practical management. They've escalated to the realm of the ultimate.
So let's talk about that term, ultimate concern, because the paper leans really heavily on the mid-20th century philosopher Paul Tillich for this concept.
Yes, Tillich is foundational here.
Because when we use the word ultimate in this context, we aren't just saying something is really, really important.
No, no. We are talking about the absolute organizing principle of a society.
Okay.
Tillich's idea is that human beings and the communities they form live by what they treat as sacred.
What they revere.
Right. And ultimate concern is whatever a group of people will protect at all absolute costs. It's what they refuse to subject to questioning. And most crucially, it's what they are willing to sacrifice for.
Wait, and the fascinating nuance here, which really caught me off guard, is that this is not strictly a theological concept.
Oh, not at all.
Like, you do not need to be deeply religious to have an ultimate concern.
Far from it. I mean, a completely secular, hyper-modern society is still driven by ultimate concerns.
Give me an example of that.
Well, the concept of the nation state can easily become an ultimate concern. Unfettered market growth.
Yeah.
Right. Absolute technological mastery, national security.
Or even like a historical narrative of revenge.
Exactly. Any of these can be elevated to the status of the sacred. Whenever a society says, you know, this specific thing must survive, even if living beings have to die to ensure it, you have identified their ultimate concern.
Wow. Okay, so if living things have to die to protect the concept, that concept is their god.
In a functional sense, yes.
Yeah.
That is their ultimate concern.
Which introduces one of the most vital and honestly terrifying frameworks in this entire deep dive, the concept of sacred insecurity.
Yes. Sacred insecurity. This is where it gets really complex.
So what is it?
Sacred insecurity is a phenomenon that occurs when multiple foundational elements of a society's existence, so their collective trauma, their sense of identity, their connection to a specific land, their religious narratives, their political sovereignty, and their literal biological survival, when all of those things fuse together into one massive, impenetrable ultimate concern.
So they basically form this supernaut of identity.
Exactly.
So if I'm a leader operating under sacred insecurity, I'm no longer just saying, hey, I'm worried about the permeability of my Western border.
Right. It's not a border dispute anymore.
I'm saying if I lose control of this border, I lose my history, I lose my ancestors, my relationship with the divine, and my fundamental right to exist as a people.
Yes. And that changes the entire psychological and moral landscape of a conflict.
Because the stakes are infinite.
Because the stakes are infinite. Huh. When those elements fuse so completely, the very concept of ordinary compromise looks like an act of existential betrayal. The other group in the conflict is no longer viewed as a political rival with competing interests. You know, they aren't just across the aisle. They are perceived as a literal metaphysical threat to your survival.
I was trying to visualize how this actually functions when I was reading the paper, and the best analogy I could come up with is an autoimmune disorder.
Oh, that's a really good way to think about it.
Because if you think about the human body, an autoimmune disease happens when the immune system, which is the very mechanism designed to protect you, right?
Right.
It becomes so hypervigilant, so terrified of a perceived threat that it goes into overdrive. It stops distinguishing between a foreign pathogen and its own healthy tissue.
It attacks itself.
Yeah. It starts destroying the very body it's trying to save just to reestablish a feeling of safety. And in a state of sacred insecurity, a society does the exact same thing.
That's entirely accurate.
It destroys the shared conditions required for life.
Mm-hmm.
The infrastructure, the trust, the environment in this desperate bid to feel secure.
That analogy perfectly captures the tragic irony of the condition. Because in a state of sacred insecurity, the violent destruction of healthy tissue, or in the geopolitical sense, the destruction of civilian lives and habitats, it feels entirely defensive to the people doing it.
Wow. even if they are the ones dropping bombs, it feels defensive.
Absolutely. The suffering inflicted on the other side is seamlessly rationalized as a tragic but, you know, absolutely unavoidable necessity. A dispute over land or resources morphs into a holy war, even if the weapons being used are completely secular.
But I do want to push back on this for a second, because if you're listening to this and you're putting yourself in the shoes of a nation that's actually under threat, you might say, well, wait a minute. Security is actually necessary.
Sure.
Right? Like, if a nation is physically attacked by missiles or terrorized by armed groups, prioritizing your own survival isn't some abstract sacred distortion. It's just a practical biological necessity.
And Dr. Sanili does not dispute that reality for a second. The framework is remarkably grounded in that regard.
Here.
Physical security is recognized as a fundamental, legitimate life good. I mean, human beings cannot flourish, trauma cannot be healed, and societies cannot develop without a baseline of safety.
Right, you need a roof over your head that isn't caving in.
Exactly. But the paper makes a razor-sharp defining distinction here, and this is crucial. It distinguishes between life protection and domination.
Okay, life protection versus domination. How do we actually separate those two in practice? Because they often look identical in military press briefings, don't they?
They do. They use the exact same vocabulary. But the difference lies in the mechanism and the ultimate outcome for life capacity.
Okay, break that down.
So life protection means actively shielding civilians. It means deploying defense systems, preserving water sources, ensuring housing, and maintaining the physical safety of your population.
That's the baseline.
Right. Domination, however, occurs when you organize another people's permanent insecurity in the name of your own protection.
Organizing another people's insecurity. That is, man, that is a chilling phrase.
It forces us to look at the structural reality. If your version of security requires the permanent humiliation or the systemic dispossession or the ongoing statelessness of another group of human beings, then security has warped into an idol.
It's no longer just protection.
No. It has crossed the line from protecting life to demanding the sacrifice of others' lives to maintain a sense of control. That is the essence of a sacred distortion.
So if these ultimate concerns and these distortions are driving these endless cyclical conflicts, how do we evaluate our own societies? How do we know if our concerns are healthy or if we're, you know, slipping into that autoimmune response we talked about?
The paper argues that we have to fundamentally upgrade our societal toolset.
Meaning what exactly?
Well, for the last century, the primary tool of the modern nation state has been measurement. We quantify everything.
We love a good metric.
We do. But Dr. Sali says we need to transition from a culture of measurement to a culture of discernment.
Okay, this connects to a massive movement in economics right now, actually. The push to move beyond GDP.
Yes, exactly.
It's this realization that a society has to stop evaluating its success purely by economic output. Because, I mean, producing more weapons, selling more antidepressants, cleaning up massive oil spills, all of those things increase GDP.
Right, the numbers go up.
But they don't mean a society is actually thriving, so we have to start measuring life capacity. Like, are people actually living well, with dignity and access to what they need?
Dr. Sumley provides a quote in the text that serves as the pivot point for this entire argument. He writes, "Measurement asks what counts as progress. Discernment asks what is worthy of ultimacy."
What is worthy of ultimacy? Wow. That distinction really changes everything about how a government or institution operates.
It does, because dashboards, economic metrics, and even casualty counts in a war zone, they are necessary tools. They make harm visible.
Sure.
But measurement without discernment just produces very accurate dashboards of catastrophe.
Oof. Accurate dashboards of catastrophe.
Right. I mean, a casualty count can tell a military commander exactly how many civilians died in an airstrike. But the spreadsheet cannot tell us what that suffering asks of us as moral beings.
Right, it's just data.
Exactly. A state can count civilian deaths with total precision and then simply continue the exact same military practices that produce those deaths.
Because the measurement doesn't challenge the ultimate concern. It just tallies the cost.
You hit the nail on the head.
So discernment then is asking the deeper question, like, what are we actually treating as sacred here? Are we worshiping our own security apparatus while ignoring the fact that it requires the constant generation of human misery?
Precisely. Now, historically, humanity hasn't used spreadsheets to organize these ultimate concerns.
Right, obviously.
We've used organized religion. Religion has functioned as the primary civil commons of meaning for thousands of years.
And at its best, that civil commons is really beautiful, right?
Absolutely.
It provides the rituals for processing grief so that a community doesn't immediately turn its pain into a demand for violent retaliation. It offers frameworks for gratitude, for recognizing the inherent worth of the vulnerable.
Yes.
And critically, for reminding powerful rulers that their authority is not the ultimate truth of the universe.
Right. It acts as a check on power. But any vessel powerful enough to organize ultimate meaning is also incredibly dangerous. The paper warns of a phenomenon called the Great Inversion.
The Great Inversion, which is essentially the sociological definition of idolatry.
It is idolatry in its purest form. The Great Inversion happens when the vessel designed to serve life suddenly demands that life serve the vessel.
Let me make sure I've got this. That's the moment when preserving the reputation of a religious institution, say, becomes more sacred than protecting the victims that institution has actively armed.
Yes, exactly that.
Or when strict adherence to a specific doctrine becomes more sacred than demonstrating actual compassion to the person standing right in front of you.
Precisely. And the paper brings in the psychoanalyst Eric Fromm here. His work is integrated deeply into this section of the text.
Derek Fromm, yeah.
Fromm Rum makes a brilliant and very necessary distinction between two fundamentally different types of religion. He calls them humanistic religion and authoritarian religion.
So unpack that for us, because I think if you're listening to this, you've probably encountered both of these, maybe even within the exact same religious denomination.
Well, you absolutely have, because the distinction isn't about which God you believe in or what text you read. It's about the psychological structure of the belief.
Okay.
Fromm argues that humanistic religion is centered entirely on the unfolding of human capacities. It exists to develop our capacity for love, our capacity for reason, and our sense of solidarity with others.
That's expansive.
Yes. The core emotion of humanistic religion is a profound joy in existing.
And authoritarian religion.
Authoritarian religion centers entirely on submission to an external, unyielding power. Its architecture relies on instilling guilt, demanding fear, enforcing strict hierarchies, and convincing the individual of their own inherent unworthiness.
That's very contracting.
Extremely. The core emotional driver is not joy, but obedience.
And when you look at how geopolitical conflicts escalate, authoritarian religion is just the perfect fuel for domination.
It's the premium fuel.
Right. Because if an entire population is psychologically trained from childhood to surrender their own conscience to an authority figure, to suppress their own emotional truth, to obey institutions without question, I mean, they are incredibly easy to mobilize.
They're primed for it.
When a political leader stands up and claims they have, you know, divine sanction to wipe out an enemy, a population conditioned by authoritarian religion will not push back. They've been taught that questioning authority is literally a sin.
They have been hollowed out of their capacity for discernment. So the question the white paper attempts to answer is, how do we get that capacity back?
Right.
If we know we need to shift from merely measuring harm to actually discerning what serves life, how do we build a framework to do that?
Well, to build this life-coherent framework, Dr. Saley synthesizes the work of five major thinkers across very different disciplines.
Yes, five very distinct lenses.
We're talking biology, philosophy, sociology, psychology. And we really need to explore each of these lenses because if you leave them together, they form the complete diagnostic architecture of the entire paper.
Right. And the starting point has to be biological. We have to understand the physical reality of how we interact with the world.
Which brings in the biologist Humberto Maturana and his concept of the biology of love.
Yes, Maturana.
Now, I have to say, the biology of love sounds like a title for a romantic poetry anthology.
It does sound a bit soft, doesn't it?
It really does. Well, but Maturana is dealing with hardcore relational biology and neuroscience here.
Oh, absolutely.
He argues that human beings do not just passively exist in a pre-given objective world, simply observing facts. Through our language and our emotions, we literally bring forth worlds.
It's a profound shift in how we understand perception. Maturana observed that human beings are fundamentally formed in emotional domains.
Meaning,
if a society lives entirely in the emotional domain of fear, it biologically brings forth a world characterized by constant looming threat.
Your nervous system actually constructs that reality.
Exactly. If a community lives in the domain of humiliation, it brings forth a world defined by resentment and the overwhelming desire to restore honor.
And where does love fit into this biological framework? Because again, it sounds very romantic.
For Maturana, love is not a sentiment or a romance or just a feeling of deep affection. Biologically speaking, love is the specific relational domain where the other person is allowed to appear as legitimate in coexistence.
Okay, let's linger on that phrase, legitimate in coexistence.
It's the cornerstone phrase.
It means their existence fundamentally belongs in the shared moral field. Mm-hmm. Like, their children's safety matters just as much as yours. Their fears recognized as valid. Their need for a future is acknowledged.
Yes. Which means domination is the biological failure of love.
Oh, wow.
Domination is the systemic, societal denial of the other's legitimate coexistence. It's the act of bringing forth a world where the other only exists as an obstacle, a threat, or a resource to be managed.
So if biology establishes that we must recognize the legitimacy of the other, how do we evaluate the vast political and economic systems we build to actually manage that coexistence?
That is exactly where the second thinker comes in, the philosopher John McMurtry. He introduces the concept of life value.
Life of value.
Right. McMurtry gives this entire framework its normative spine. He looks at all the complex systems humanity has constructed, global capitalism, national security doctrines, organized religions, and he argues that every single one of them must be tested by a single uncompromising criterion.
Which is?
Does a system expand or does it reduce life capacity?
Life capacity. And we're talking about a very tangible metric here. Clean water, secure shelter, physical safety, human dignity, education, a stable ecological environment.
The literal requirements for biological and social thriving. And the McMurtry defines a false religion or a toxic ideology really is any value system that becomes closed against correction by life.
Closed against correction by life. Think about what that means in practice. Mm-hmm. A system is operating, it is actively damaging life. But the internal logic of the system refuses to learn from the suffering it's causing.
Yes. Take economic policy as an example.
Okay.
If a specific structural economic system predictably causes mass poverty, homelessness, and food insecurity.
Which many do.
Right. But the defenders of that system simply blame the poor for lacking work ethic. That system is closed against correction. It refuses to adjust to the reality of the suffering it creates.
Or to apply it to warfare. If a military strategy consistently results in thousands of civilian casualties and the leadership simply categorizes those deaths as regrettable collateral damage without fundamentally altering their tactics to prevent them,
then that military doctrine operates as a false religion.
It worships its own strategic rules more than it values living, breathing human beings.
Exactly. When a system is closed against correction, it inherently produces violence. But we have to be very careful about how we define that violence.
Right, which requires the lens of the third thinker, Johann Galtung.
Yes, one of the principal founders of peace and conflict studies.
Galtung's work is vital here. But I know many people struggle with how academic circles use the word violence today.
It gets debated constantly.
It really does. Because Galtung introduces different categories. We all intuitively understand what direct violence is. It's kinetic. It's bombs dropping, bullets firing, physical assault.
The obvious stuff.
Right. But the text leans heavily into Galtung's concepts of structural and cultural violence. And if you're listening to this, you might be thinking, doesn't calling a lack of universal health care or zoning law violence? Doesn't that dilute the severity of the word? Like, if everything uncomfortable is violence, doesn't the word lose its meaning?
It is a very common and understandable critique.
Mm.
But Galtung's framework is actually incredibly precise.
How so?
He argues that if we only pay attention to direct kinetic violence, we become completely blind to the machinery that generates it.
Okay.
Structural violence occurs when the societal arrangements themselves predictably and consistently injure life.
Think about what that looks like on the ground. Imagine a person who is stateless. They need to cross a checkpoint to reach a hospital for dialysis.
A very real scenario.
They are denied entry not by a soldier firing a weapon, but by a bureaucratic mandate regarding travel permits. They return home, and eventually they die from a completely treatable condition. No guns were fired. But the architecture of that society drastically reduced their life capacity and resulted in their death. That is structural violence.
Perfectly stated. A military blockade, a deeply unequal legal system, systematic redlining that forces populations into environmental hazard zones, these arrangements destroy life. People die from structural violence just as surely as they die from shrapnel.
The timeline is just slower.
The timeline is slower, and the perpetrators are hidden behind paperwork and policy.
So how does a society tolerate that level of invisible harm without revolting?
That is the role of cultural violence.
Ah.
Cultural violence is the narrative layer that sits on top of the structure. It is the language used in school textbooks, the framing of stories in the nightly news, and the dehumanizing theology preached from pulpits that makes both direct and structural violence seem entirely justified.
Or natural. Duh. Or invisible.
Exactly.
So cultural violence is the story that says, hey, those people are inherently dangerous, they only understand force, and therefore keeping them under a permanent blockade is just common sense.
Right.
It provides the moral permission slip for the structural violence to continue unbothered.
Which leads to Galtung's most famous and resonant distinction. The difference between negative peace and positive peace.
This is a huge word.
Negative peace is merely the silence of the guns. It is a ceasefire. It means the direct violence is temporarily paused.
But if you have a ceasefire where one group of people is still living under a blockade, still stateless, and still lacking access to clean water, you only have negative peace.
Right.
It is quiet, but it is not peaceful. Positive peace requires the actual presence of life-enabling conditions, justice, dignity, mobility, and access to resources.
But people living under those conditions of negative peace, experiencing structural violence daily, they don't just experience it as an intellectual policy problem. They experience it biologically. They feel it.
Which brings us to the fourth thinker, Catherine Pale Kaufman, who explores the role of emotion as an evolutionary moral compass.
Yes. Now, modern political and legal systems love to split reason from emotion.
We're so trained to do that. We are taught that to be rational, we must suppress our feelings. Emotion is treated as irrational noise that clouds judgment.
Pale Kaufman entirely rejects that split. She argues that our emotions are a highly evolved biological guidance system designed to protect life.
Okay, give me an example. When we experience grief, it is not just a breakdown. It is a vital signal that something deeply loved has been lost. When a community experiences rage, it's a biological alarm bell, signaling that a fundamental boundary has been violently violated. Shame is an indicator of a wound to dignity.
Emotions are truthful indicators of where life has been damaged. But, and this is a big but, the white paper is very careful to warn about what happens when those emotions are hijacked.
This is the critical juncture. Emotions are always true signals of a wound. But the profound danger arises when those emotions are captured by the desire for revenge.
Right.
A historical wound absolutely explains a community's rage. But emotional truth is not the same thing as moral authorization.
That is such a crucial razor-thin line to walk, validating the emotion without authorizing the destruction.
Exactly.
Because if a nation suffers a horrific terrorist attack, their grief and rage are 100% legitimate. But that profound historical wound does not give them moral permission to cross the border and wound others without limit.
No, it doesn't.
The pain is real, but it cannot be weaponized into a blank check for domination.
And the determining factor in whether a society uses its pain for repair or for revenge depends entirely on its psychological and spiritual maturity.
Which leads us to the final thinker in the diagnostic framework, the integral philosopher Ken Wilber.
Wilber provides a really useful developmental lens.
He maps human growth across four distinct processes: waking up, growing up, cleaning up, and showing up. And this is where the concept of spiritual bypass comes in, which I think is one of the most useful psychological tools to understand modern conflict.
Mm.
So let's break down Wilber's four steps.
Sure. So waking up refers to states of consciousness. It's the experience of profound spiritual revelation, feeling a deep sense of awe, a connection to the divine, or a realization of the interconnectedness of the universe. It's a very real, transcendent experience.
But Wilber points out the trap here. You can have a genuine waking up experience, but if you haven't done the hard cognitive work of growing up, meaning you still view the world through an immature, highly tribal, us versus them moral lens, you will filter that profound revelation right through your tribalism.
Exactly. You experience the divine, but because your moral framework is stunted, mm-hmm. you interpret that divine presence as saying, you are the chosen people, your specific tribe is favored by the universe, and everyone outside your border is a cosmic enemy.
The spiritual energy actually supercharges the tribal violence.
It does. It makes it absolute.
And what about cleaning up?
Cleaning up refers to shadow work. It's the grueling psychological process of dealing with your own unhealed trauma, your oppressions, and your tendency to project your own darkness onto other people.
Right.
If you try to engage in peace building without cleaning up, you inevitably fall into spiritual bypass.
We see this all the time in interpersonal relationships, but it scales up to the geopolitical level too.
Oh, absolutely.
Spiritual bypass is using spiritual or pacifist language to avoid actual accountability. It's the politician who says, you know, we just need to forgive and forget, let us look to the future, without ever acknowledging, let alone repairing, the massive structural harm their policies just caused.
Right.
It sounds incredibly peaceful and enlightened, but it is actually an evasion of responsibility. It leaves the structural violence completely intact.
And finally, showing up means integrating all of this. It means taking your waking up, your growing up, your cleaning up, and actively applying it in the complex, messy, material world to build positive peace.
Okay, so if we take these five lenses, Maturana's biology of coexistence, McMurtry's test of life capacity, Galtung's structural violence, Pell Kaufman's emotional compass, and Wilbur's developmental maturity, we finally have a complete diagnostic x-ray machine.
We do. We can now look at the symptoms of a diseased conflict.
The paper categorizes these symptoms as the failure modes of sacred incoherence. These are the specific, identifiable mechanisms by which legitimate concerns for safety or justice warp into toxic, life-destroying ideologies.
And there are several of them.
Let's start with the first failure mode.
Yeah.
And this requires incredibly sensitive handling because it deals with real pain. Weaponized victimhood.
Yes, weaponized victimhood. It's a dynamic that occurs when the very real, often horrific suffering of a specific group becomes the exact mechanism they use to deny the suffering of others.
And we have to state unequivocally, the initial suffering that forms this identity is almost always completely real. It might be centuries of persecution, a profound historical trauma, or an ongoing systemic injustice.
Yes, but the failure mode kicks in when that trauma crystallizes into an identity that creates a terrifying moral asymmetry.
Right. If you're listening and thinking about global conflicts, you can hear this logic operating all the time. The logic dictates, because we have suffered so uniquely in the past, anything we do now is purely defensive.
Right.
Because our historical dead are sacred, the people we are killing right now are just unfortunate collateral damage.
Okay. The historical wound transforms into an impenetrable shield against any present-day accountability. The suffering of the opponent is viewed entirely through the lens of one's own victimhood, rendering the opponent's pain secondary, invisible, or worse, somehow deserved.
The second failure mode builds right on this. It's the concept of redemptive violence. And I really want to linger here because this is the belief that violence isn't just an ugly tool of last resort, but that violence itself has the power to purify, to cleanse, or to save the world.
Redemptive violence is arguably the most seductive ideology in human history. It gives the infliction of harm a sacred aura. It convinces communities that their violent actions are not just regrettable necessities of war, but holy acts of liberation or divine justice.
And once violence is viewed as redemptive, it turns traditional moral breaks into moral fuel.
That is the exact mechanism. If violence is the path to salvation, then demonstrating restraint starts to look like a moral failure.
It looks like weakness.
Exactly. Furthermore, any civilian suffering that occurs on your own side is no longer viewed as a catastrophic failure of leadership or policy. It is suddenly elevated to the status of a necessary, glorious sacrifice required for the ultimate victory. The destruction of life is sanctified.
Another deeply connected failure mode is enemy absolutization and scapegoating. The white paper links this back to the theories of the French historian and philosopher René Girard.
Yes, Girard's work on scapegoating is essential here. He theorized that human communities, when placed under intense internal stress, conflict, or fear, will almost inevitably seek to create artificial unity by projecting all of their internal disorder onto a single scapegoat.
This could be an internal minority, a heretic, or an external enemy nation.
Right. Enemy absolutization is the process of methodically stripping the opponent of every single ounce of their complex humanity. They are no longer viewed as an adversary who happens to have conflicting political interests or legitimate fears of their own.
They are flattened into a caricature.
They are transformed into the literal, metaphysical embodiment of evil.
And the danger of absolutizing the enemy is that once you genuinely believe you are fighting pure, unadulterated evil, the concept of proportionality vanishes.
It's gone.
Right. There is no such thing as an extreme response to pure evil. Every atrocity becomes justifiable because the alternative, letting evil survive, is unthinkable.
Exactly.
You know, as I was reading through these failure modes, weaponized victimhood, redemptive violence, enemy absolutization, I couldn't help but think of them like a highly tuned malicious algorithm in a social media feed.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Think about your own experience online. Once the algorithm learns that outrage, fear, and enemy making keep your eyes glued to the screen, it entirely stops showing you anything that might humanize the people you disagree with. It creates a self-sealing loop of alternate reality.
It really does.
And on a geopolitical scale, it works the exact same way. A population only sees the absolute worst, most violent actions of the other side. This confirms their deepest fears. Those fears are then used to justify their own violent response. Their violent response creates a fresh, horrific wound on the other side, which then justifies the other side's retaliation. The loop tightens and tightens, and the shared conditions for life are pulverized in the middle.
That algorithmic loop you just described is the exact operational definition of sacred insecurity. It is a closed system where every action taken by one side provides the unquestionable evidence required to validate the other side's darkest narrative.
So we have the theory. But how does this highly philosophical, biological, and psychological framework hold up in the brutal reality of the real world?
This is where Dr. Saheeli's paper does something incredibly brave and, frankly, risky.
It rigorously stress tests its own diagnostic tool against what is arguably the most intractable, deeply painful, and polarizing geopolitical conflict on Earth, the Middle East.
It is the ultimate testing grounds for the concept of life coherence.
I want to pause right here and offer a very explicit note to you, the listener. As we walk through this stress test, we are adhering strictly to the paper's mandate of absolute impartiality. We are not engaging in punditry, and we are not endorsing a side.
No, we are simply reporting.
We are reporting how Dr. Saheeli analytically applies this life-coherent framework to the realities on the ground. The paper sets an uncompromising baseline, and I quote, "No people's wound should be denied, and no people's wound should be allowed to sanctify the destruction of another."
That sentence is the threshold for entering a life-coherent dialogue. To apply the framework, the process must begin by recognizing the profound, undeniable life truths on both sides, utterly refusing to minimize either narrative.
Okay, let's begin by examining how the paper recognizes Palestinian life truths.
The framework explicitly and unequivocally names the historical and present reality of Palestinian trauma. It recognizes the dispossession of land, the reality of military occupation, intergenerational displacement, the blockade, statelessness, and the systematic denial of meaningful self-determination.
And applying Galtung's lens, these are not named merely as political grievances or talking points for a negotiation table. They are identified as structural violence.
Yes.
They are life-destroying conditions that actively and severely reduce life capacity. A population fundamentally cannot flourish biologically, economically, or psychologically when its movement, its access to resources, and its basic dignity are systematically controlled and restricted by another power. That structural reality must be repaired for positive peace to exist.
Simultaneously, and with equal weight, the paper recognizes Israeli and Jewish life truths.
How does it frame those?
It explicitly names the profound historical trauma of global antisemitism, the unimaginable horrors of the Holocaust, and the very present reality of terrorism, hostage-taking, indiscriminate rocket fire, and the constant existential fear of annihilation.
And this is where the framework is so crucial. Jewish security is not treated as a hyperbolic political excuse. It is recognized as a non-negotiable legitimate life good. The need for a safe, secure communal life, completely free from the threat of extermination or terror, is an absolute biological requirement for life capacity.
The paper demands that anyone seeking peace must hold both of those profound truths, the devastating reality of structural occupation and the terrifying reality of existential threat simultaneously.
Right.
But then the framework moves to the hardest phase, determining what must be de-implemented.
De-implementation means looking at the actions currently being taken by both sides to secure their ultimate concerns and demanding that the tactics which are inherently life-destroying lose all legitimacy.
Correct. Applying the test of life value, the framework states that on one side, the taking of hostages, the deliberate targeting of civilians, and any form of collective punishment must be entirely de-implemented.
It's non-negotiable.
Completely non-negotiable. The paper argues firmly that no struggle for liberation, no matter how structurally oppressed a population is, becomes life coherent or just by treating unarmed families as leverage or targets.
And on the other side?
The permanent military occupation, the expansion of settlements that fragment territory and displace communities, and any rhetoric or ideology that suggests annihilation must be de-implemented.
Okay.
The framework argues that a state cannot achieve true life-coherent security by manufacturing the permanent insecurity, humiliation, and statelessness of a neighboring people.
Oh.
Furthermore, the paper calls out the international community, demanding an end to proxy warfare and selective legality, where international laws are aggressively applied to geopolitical enemies, but conveniently ignored when violated by allies.
Okay, I have to interject here, because this is where the theory hits a wall of human terror.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
Right, because it is incredibly easy for us to sit in a studio and say, well, both sides just need to stop doing bad things.
Right.
But if you are a population locked deep inside a state of sacred insecurity, giving up your primary tactics feels like literal suicide. If you genuinely believe the other side is trying to eradicate you, putting down your weapons or dismantling a military occupation feels like exposing your neck to a blade. How does this paper address the sheer, paralyzing terror of compromise?
That is the most difficult question in peace building. And Dr. Saheeli addresses it through the concept of reciprocal security guarantees.
How does that actually work in a landscape with zero trust?
The core insight is that you cannot ask a deeply traumatized people to surrender their primary method of threat management, even if that method is a toxic distortion like permanent occupation or armed militancy, without simultaneously offering them a credible, life-coherent protection in its place.
It makes me think of two people holding a live high-voltage wire. Both are being electrocuted, but both know that if they let go of the wire before the other person does, the power surge will kill them instantly. They have to figure out a way to synchronize letting go of the wire to the exact millisecond.
That is a phenomenal analogy. Every single step toward security must reduce the dynamics of domination. And every reduction in armed threat must be matched millimeter by millimeter by a credible restoration of human rights and structural dignity.
It has to be perfectly synchronized.
Yes. You cannot demand that people give up what they view as their only defense mechanism without providing a deeper, shared structural protection. Historical compromises fail because they ask populations to surrender their ultimate meaning, their safety, or their liberation, without offering a life-coherent reality to replace it.
Which brings us to the final action-oriented phase of the deep dive. We have explored the biology of coexistence, we've diagnosed the failure modes, and we've looked at the harrowing Middle East stress test. How does this framework propose we actually sequence the building of peace?
Dr. Saheeli outlines an 8-step discernment and repair cycle.
Let's walk through it.
And it is vital to view this not as a bureaucratic checklist, but as a deep psychological and structural journey. Step one is recognize the wound. This is the absolute prerequisite. A historical or present wound that is not recognized cannot be mourned. And as we discuss with P.O. Kaufman's work, if a wound cannot be mourned, the emotion metastasizes into revenge.
But the discipline of step one is recognizing the wound without letting it become sovereign over life. You acknowledge the pain, but you do not let it write a blank check for future violence.
Exactly.
Which flows into step two. Name the ultimate concern. You have to ask what is actually driving the fear beneath the violence. Is it a desperate need for physical security? Is it a deep tie to sacred land? Is it an overwhelming need for dignity after decades of structural humiliation?
Once you name the concern, you move to step three.
Yeah.
Expose the sacred distortion. This is the delicate work of separating the legitimate human need from the toxic method used to achieve it. It is the ability to say your need for security is entirely real and valid. But the permanent domination of your neighbor is the distortion. Or your need for liberation is undeniably valid. But targeting civilians is the distortion.
Step four is where the evaluation happens. Distinguish life protection from life destruction. You have to look unflinchingly at the actions being taken by your own side. Are these policies actually shielding people and preserving life? Or are they simply destroying the life capacity of the other side under the socially acceptable guise of defense?
And if it is the latter, you reach step five, the hardest action of all, de-implement harmful patterns. This goes beyond just signing a piece of paper. It means actively withdrawing financial resources, cultural legitimacy, theological backing, and institutional support from the military or structural actions that predictably destroy life.
But you cannot just dismantle a system and leave a vacuum because fear will rush right back in. That brings us to step six. Restore the commons of coexistence. You have to literally rebuild the shared material conditions that allow people to live side by side.
The material realities.
This means restoring access to water, ensuring food security, guaranteeing safe mobility, establishing equitable civic rights, and creating truthful media ecosystems. You have to make the daily act of coexistence practically, physically livable.
Which creates the space for step seven. Repair life capacity. This is the generational work. This is the deep trauma healing, the communal grief work, and the rebuilding of civic institutions. A peace treaty is just a piece of paper if the nervous systems of the populations are still biologically trapped in terror.
And finally, step 8, conserve the conditions of peace. Recognizing that positive peace is not an event that happens once, it is a daily practice. You have to actively protect these newly built systems of coexistence from being recaptured by political fearmongers, outrage algorithms, or the inevitable resurgence of historical grievances.
And to anchor this entire 8-step cycle, Dr. Seah Healey offers one profoundly moving, non-negotiable benchmark. The clearest, most undeniable test of whether a society is operating with life coherence is the sacred protection of children.
I want everyone listening to just hold that thought for a moment. The sacred protection of children.
The paper argues with absolute moral clarity that any political framework, any liberation movement, any military strategy, or any religious doctrine that cannot protect children has failed at the absolute root.
Wow.
Children are the baseline of life capacity. If your society's ultimate concern, whether it is the state, the land, or the doctrine, requires the sacrifice, the trauma, or the starvation of children, whether they are your children or the enemy's children, then your ultimate concern is a false idol.
So when we pull all the way back and look at this entire diagnostic tool, what does this all mean for us? It means that our entire definition of the goal has to change. True peace is not just a negotiated treaty drawn up in Geneva. It is not just drawing new borders on a map, and it is certainly not just a temporary ceasefire that leaves millions living in structural misery.
Those are just varying degrees of negative peace. They are the mere absence of bombing.
True. Positive peace requires the meticulous, exhausting, beautiful work of restoring the actual material and psychological conditions that allow human life to flourish. It requires the presence of health, dignity, structural rights, and the shared space to mourn.
It demands a massive evolution in how we approach human conflict. True discernment isn't just about analyzing what we measure, like GDP or casualty counts. It is about deeply examining what we revere, what we are willing to protect at all costs, and critically, what living beings we're willing to sacrifice to maintain our illusions of control.
I want to thank you for guiding us through this incredibly dense, challenging, and paradigm-shifting white paper. Dr. Saley's work is incredibly heavy, but it feels like necessary medicine for the moment we are living in.
It was an absolute pleasure.
And to you, the listener, you do not have to be a UN diplomat or a peace studies professor to apply this framework. You can use this exact diagnostic tool in your own life. You can apply it to conflicts in your community, dynamics in your workplace, or deep rifts in your own family. And most importantly, you can use it as a filter for your own media consumption. The next time you are reading a heated news story or listening to a politician demand action, you can ask yourself the fundamental question: does this narrative expand life capacity, or does it attempt to convince me that someone else is disposable?
And as we close, I want to leave you with the final provocative question posed in the appendix of Dr. Zahili's paper. It is a question that requires deep honesty. Look closely at the systems, the political beliefs, the national identities, or the institutions that you hold most dear. What finite, constructed thing in your life has been elevated to the absolute? And if it came right down to it, what living things are you actively or passively sacrificing to keep that abstraction alive?
We may not have a clean, binary X-ray machine to perfectly diagnose the muddy waters of human conflict, but having the courage to ask that question is the first real step toward a cure. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking the hard questions, keep challenging the narratives of domination, and keep looking out for the conditions that allow life to flourish.